The sun is setting, Your Grace. In 1 hour, I lose everything. I need a husband by sunset.
I will give you my name, Grace. But you must follow my one condition.
I need a husband by sunset, she said. The ruthless Duke gave her one dangerous condition. 4 o'clock. The sun has already begun to bleed across the London sky. Grace Sutherland stands outside the most exclusive ballroom in Mayfair, clutching a gold pocket watch so tightly her knuckles have gone white. She has 4 hours. 4 hours to find a husband, or lose her name, her home, and her freedom to the cold walls of Newgate Prison. The guards turn her away twice. She comes back a third time, because desperation does something to a woman. It strips away pride. It strips away fear. It leaves only one thing, the will to survive at any cost. She gets inside. The ballroom is blinding. Chandelier light, silk gowns, powdered laughter. And there, standing apart from all of it still, silent and dangerous, is Duke Patrick Jameson, the one man every person in this room avoids, the one man Grace has no choice but to walk toward. He sees her coming. He doesn't move. When she finally stands before him and speaks, he says nothing for a long moment. Then he reaches into his coat, places a single card on the table between them, and says, "There is one condition." Grace doesn't know yet what that condition will cost her, but she's about to find out. Stay with me. Welcome to Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles. If you're ready for stories where the unexpected happens, where the forgotten rise and the underdogs turn the game around, hit that subscribe button now. You don't want to miss what's coming next. Drop a comment below and tell me your name, where you're watching from, and what's on your mind. Your name might be the one called out at the start of the next story. Like, share, and hit that notification bell so you never miss the drama, the revenge, and the secrets waiting to be uncovered. Welcome to the family. Now, let's dive in. The contract was signed before the last light left the sky. Grace Sutherland stood in the center of the Jameson private receiving room. A smaller, quieter space the Duke had requested after her approach caught the attention of half the ballroom. The room smelled of leather and old wood, and something faintly medicinal, like a space that had not entertained warmth in a very long time. A single candelabra burned on the writing desk. The flame did not flicker. Even the fire in this house, it seemed, had learned to be still. Duke Patrick Jameson sat across from her, one leg crossed over the other, his navy blue velvet frock coat immaculate despite the hour. He had the kind of face that artists would have argued over: sharp jaw, dark eyes that gave nothing away, a mouth that looked as though it had forgotten the shape of a smile long ago. He read the summary she had presented without a single change in expression. The ticking of the mantel clock was the loudest thing in the room. Grace watched him and kept her hands folded in her lap so he would not see them trembling. When he finally set the papers down and looked at her, it was not with pity, and it was not with contempt. It was with the careful, measuring look of a man, calculating the weight of a decision that had already been made. He told her he would clear the debt. Every last figure her father had accumulated through years of reckless gambling would be dissolved before the week was done. The Sutherland name would not appear in any court record. She would not see the inside of Newgate Prison. She would instead see the inside of Jameson Manor as its duchess, for however long the arrangement required. But there were terms. The west wing of the manor was not a part of her residence. The private study on the upper floor was not a room she would ever enter. She was not to ask questions about his dealings in Parliament, his correspondences, or the men who came and went from the estate at irregular hours. She was to be a convincing wife in every public setting, compelled gracious and in full command of the role. In private, she was a guest. Nothing more. Grace listened to every word without interrupting him. Then she asked, quietly, if there was anything else. He looked at her for a moment longer than was necessary. Then he said there was one final condition, and it was the most important of all. She was not to seek his affection. She was not to confuse proximity for intimacy, or politeness for warmth. What they were building was a structure, not a home, a transaction, not a life. He had no interest in her heart, and she was to have no interest in his. Grace thought of the pocket watch still pressed against her palm. She thought of Newgate, She thought of her father's study, empty now, stripped of every painting she had ever loved. She picked up the pen and signed her name. The ink dried in the candlelight. The Duke rose, called for his steward, and left the room without another word. Grace sat alone for a moment in the silence, the contract before her, and understood, with perfect clarity, that she had just traded one kind of cage for another. The difference was that this one had curtains. Jameson Manor revealed itself to Grace the following morning in the gray, reluctant light of an English dawn. She had arrived the evening before with one trunk, everything that remained of the Sutherland household, after the barrister had catalogued and claimed the rest. One trunk for 23 years of living. She had packed her sketchbooks, 3 gowns, her mother's earrings, and the pocket watch. She had left the grief at the door, because grief was a luxury she could not afford inside these walls. The manor was enormous in the way that certain old institutions are enormous, not with grandeur, but with permanence. It had the feeling of a building that had watched generations of people pass through it, and had formed no particular attachment to any of them. The ceilings were high, the corridors were long. The portraits along the main hallway stared down with the practiced indifference of ancestors who had seen everything and approved of very little. The housekeeper met her at the base of the main staircase. Mrs. Vanessa was a tall woman of perhaps 50, with silver-streaked hair pulled so severely from her face that it seemed to pull her expression taut as well. She had pale gray eyes that moved over Grace with the efficiency of an inventory check, cataloging every detail of the new Duchess and filing it away behind a smile that was correct in its shape but entirely absent of warmth. She welcomed Grace to Jameson Manor in a tone that suggested the word welcome was being used in its most technical sense. Grace thanked her and asked if she might be shown to her rooms. Mrs. Vanessa led her through corridors lined with glass display cases, oil paintings in heavy gilt frames, marble busts on pedestals of dark wood. There were no flowers anywhere. No scattered books or forgotten gloves or any of the small human mess that accumulates in a house where people actually live. It was, Grace thought, exactly like walking through a museum after closing time. Beautiful, preserved, and entirely devoid of life. Her rooms were at the east end of the upper floor, as far from the west wing as the floor plan allowed. They were well appointed and perfectly clean and felt when the door closed behind Mrs. Vanessa, like the loneliest rooms Grace had ever stood in. She unpacked her trunk slowly. She set her sketchbooks on the writing desk. She placed her mother's earrings in the small jewelry box on the dressing table. She hung her gowns in the wardrobe, which was large enough to swallow them whole and still echo. Then she sat on the edge of the bed and listened to the silence of the house. It was not the comfortable silence of a place at rest. It was the deliberate silence of a place holding something back. Somewhere below, she could hear the distant sound of a door closing. Footsteps. Then, nothing again. She opened her sketchbook and drew the window. Then the wardrobe. Then the strange iron candle holder on the wall that looked as though it had been designed to intimidate rather than illuminate. She drew until the light outside shifted from gray to the pale gold of mid-morning, and only then did she feel the tension in her shoulders begin, slightly, to release. She did not see the Duke that day at all. The invitation arrived 9 days after the wedding. A royal gala at Whitmore House, hosted by Lord Ashcroft on behalf of the Crown's Social Committee, an event that the entire ton had been anticipating for months, and that Grace had, until 9 days ago, never imagined she would attend as anyone's wife. The card was addressed to the Duke and Duchess of Jamieson in ink so formal it seemed almost accusatory. Patrick summoned her to the library that evening. It was the first time she had been inside the library, and despite the circumstances, she could not entirely suppress her reaction to it. 3 walls of shelves, floor to ceiling, packed with books that looked as though they had actually been read. A wide table in the center strewn with maps and correspondence. 2 deep chairs angled toward the fireplace. It was the only room in the manor that felt, to Grace, like someone had actually lived inside it. The Duke stood at the far end of the table with the invitation in his hand. He explained the situation with characteristic economy. The gala was not optional. Lord Ashcroft was a senior figure in the political structure Patrick navigated, and absence would raise questions neither of them could afford. They would attend as a couple. They would be convincing. Grace asked what convincing looked like, exactly, given that they had shared fewer than 30 words with each other since the contract was signed. Patrick set the invitation down and looked at her. He told her it looked like proximity without discomfort. A hand offered at the right moment. Eye contact sustained long enough to suggest familiarity. Nothing theatrical, nothing excessive. Simply two people who had chosen each other and were comfortable in that choice. Grace told him, without particular emotion, that they had not chosen each other. That choice had been made by debt and desperation and a clock running out of time. Something shifted in his expression then. Not quite discomfort. Something more like recognition. He acknowledged that this was true. And then he said, with a different quality in his voice, quieter, less rehearsed, that it did not mean they could not be credible. They practiced that evening in the library, which was perhaps the strangest hour Grace Sutherland had ever spent in her life. He showed her how he would offer his arm. She showed him which side she preferred to walk on. They stood at a distance calculated to suggest ease and worked at it with the careful, slightly absurd seriousness of two people who knew exactly what they were doing and why, and found it unexpectedly difficult anyway. At one point he reached over to adjust the angle of her hand on his arm, and his fingers stayed a moment longer than was necessary. Neither of them commented on it, but the air in the room changed in a way that the fire could not account for, and Grace looked up from his hand to his face and found him already looking at hers. The Duke stepped back. He thanked her for her cooperation. He said the carriage would be ready at 7 on the evening of the gala. Grace walked back to her rooms through the dark corridors of the manor and told herself, firmly and with great conviction, that she was not in the slightest bit unsettled. She believed herself for approximately 4 minutes. She had not intended to go near the West Wing. She wanted that clearly understood, if only by herself. She was not a woman who went looking for trouble. She had enough of it already, packaged neatly into a marriage contract and filed somewhere in the Duke's private study. She had respected the terms. She had kept to her rooms and the east corridors, and the library and the small morning room where she took her breakfast alone each day. But it was 2:30 in the morning, and she could not sleep, and the sound had been going on for nearly an hour. It was not a loud sound. That was what made it so difficult to dismiss. It was low and irregular, something between a voice and something else, muffled by walls and distance. She had lain in the dark listening to it until the not knowing became more unbearable than the risk of finding out. She took her candle and moved through the corridor. The west wing began where the main hallway ended, marked by a heavy door of dark oak that was, she noted with some surprise, not locked. She pushed it open slowly and stood at the threshold, listening. The sound was clearer now. Not one voice. Several. Small ones. She followed the sound down the west wing corridor, past closed doors and faded wall hangings, until she reached the last door on the left, from beneath which a line of warm light fell across the floorboards. She pressed her hand flat against the wood and listened. Children. The voices belonged to children. She did not open the door. She stood very still in the dark hallway with her candle and let the reality of it settle over her. There were children in the west wing of Jamieson Manor, in the middle of the night, in the part of the house she had been forbidden to enter, and from the sound of it, the low, murmuring quality of it, the occasional small laugh they were being tended to, she heard another sound then. Lower. Steadier. A voice she recognized. The Duke. Grace stepped back from the door and pressed herself against the wall, her heart moving faster than she wished it to. She listened to the rumble of his voice through the wood, too low to make out words, but unmistakable in its quality. It was not the voice he used in the library, measured and correct. It was something else, entirely something slower and more careful, like a man choosing words for an audience that required gentleness. She stood there longer than she should have. Then she walked back to her rooms, closed her door, and sat at the writing desk with her candle burning low. She opened her sketchbook and sat for a long time without drawing anything, because the man who had told her not to seek his affection had just shown her something that made that instruction feel, for the first time, genuinely difficult to follow. She picked up her pencil. She drew a door with light beneath it. She drew a corridor. She drew, without entirely planning to, the outline of a man sitting on the floor beside children who had no one else. She closed the sketchbook before she could think about what that meant. Declan Robertson arrived on a Tuesday, uninvited, in a carriage that had no crest on its door. Grace was in the morning room when she heard the commotion in the entrance hall, the kind of controlled commotion that occurs when a house full of trained staff encounters something they were not prepared for. She set down her tea and listened to the voices, and after a moment she heard one that was unfamiliar, smooth, well-bred, with the kind of easy confidence that comes not from achievement, but from assumption. When she reached the entrance hall, the man was already inside. He was perhaps 35, with fair hair and an open, pleasant face that had the interesting quality of being entirely likable on first glance and faintly untrustworthy on second. He wore a charcoal coat with silver buttons and carried his gloves in one hand, tapping them lightly against his palm in a gesture that managed to be both casual and deliberate. When he saw Grace, he smiled wide, warm, and immediate, in a way that reminded her of someone extending a hand before they've decided whether to shake or take. He introduced himself as Declan Robertson, the Duke's cousin. He said he had been traveling and thought he would call in, family being family, and he hoped he was not causing any inconvenience whatsoever. Grace told him the Duke was not at home. Declan said that was quite all right, that he was perfectly happy to wait, and that in the meantime he hoped the new Duchess might spare a few minutes for a friendly conversation. He had, he said, heard so much about her. She could not politely refuse. She led him to the sitting room and rang for tea, and sat across from him with her hands folded in her lap, wearing the same expression she had worn when she sat across from Patrick Jameson with a contract between them. The expression of a woman who was paying very close attention and allowing none of it to show. Declan was charming. That was the first and most important thing to understand about him. He had the kind of charm that operates on the assumption that everyone in the room has already decided to like him, which creates, in the people who haven't, a vague sense of being behind. He asked about her adjustment to the manor. He asked about her family, with a sympathy so precisely calibrated it felt almost like research. And then, with the ease of a man changing the subject at a dinner table, he began to talk about Patrick. He spoke of his cousin with a careful mixture of admiration and concern that Grace recognized immediately as neither. He mentioned Patrick's reputation in Parliament brilliant, yes, but relentless. He mentioned the men who had crossed him professionally and found themselves without influence the following season. He mentioned, almost in passing, that Patrick had a way of accumulating debts, not financial ones, but the kind that were owed to him, and that he had always been very deliberate about which debts he chose to collect and when. Grace kept her expression neutral and her teacup steady in her hand. Then Declan leaned forward slightly and said, with the gentle tone of someone sharing something reluctantly, that he had known her father, briefly, that Lord Sutherland had been a decent man caught in a current he didn't fully understand, that some of those debts, not all, but some had not accumulated entirely by chance. Grace set her cup down. She asked him what he meant by that. Declan sat back. He spread his hands in the gesture of a man who has said too much and knows it. He said only that the world of high finance and political influence was complicated, that money moved in directions that were not always visible from the outside, and that she was a perceptive woman who would, he was sure, find her own way to the truth eventually. He left before Patrick returned. He pressed her hand at the door, told her it had been a genuine pleasure, and said he hoped she would feel free to send word if she ever needed anything. The offer was extended with such warmth and such precision that it felt, to Grace, less like kindness and more like a key being pressed into her palm. She stood in the entrance hall after his carriage had gone and held the afternoon's conversation in her mind, turning it over the way she turned a subject over in her sketchbook before committing it to paper. Declan had not told her anything directly. He had not accused Patrick of anything. He had simply stood beside a window and allowed the light to fall in a certain way and trusted that she would see the shadow. She was seeing it. She simply was not yet sure whose shadow it was. When Patrick returned that evening, she was in the library. She heard his footsteps in the corridor, the pause outside the door, and then the sound of him continuing on toward his study. She looked down at her sketchbook, where she had been drawing Declan's face from memory, the pleasant smile, the careful eyes. She had drawn, without quite deciding to, a question mark in the space beside his portrait, because something about the afternoon had shifted the ground beneath her feet, and she could not yet tell whether the fault line ran through the man she had married, or through the man who had come to plant the doubt. She thought of the light beneath the west wing door, the low, careful voice reading to children in the dark. The Duke, who had built walls so high that even his own staff moved around him like furniture. She thought of her father, and debts that had appeared from nowhere, and a barrister who had arrived with papers so perfectly prepared they might have been written before the crisis that required them. She closed her sketchbook. Outside the library windows, the London night pressed in, dense and dark and full of things she did not yet know. But she was beginning to understand, with the quiet certainty of a woman who had always trusted her instincts, even when she was too frightened to follow them, that the most dangerous person in Grace Sutherland's new life was not the man she had married. It was the man who had just told her to be afraid of him. And ask yourself this before you sleep. If the person you were warned about turned out to be the only one telling you the truth, and the person who came offering kindness turned out to be the architect of everything you lost, how long do you think it would take you to see it? Grace is about to find out. If you're still here after all that, it shows you find the story interesting. If so, then do me this one favor. Hit subscribe on Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles. Also, drop a comment telling me what you think about the story so far. The best part of this story hasn't even started yet. The magistrate arrived on a gray Thursday morning with no prior notice and two assistants who waited outside the door like punctuation marks at the end of a threat. His name was Sir Aldous Krem, and he was the kind of man who had spent so many decades wielding institutional authority that it had reorganized his entire bearing around itself. He was thin, precise, and dressed in the sober colors of a man who considered personal style a form of frivolity. He carried a leather folio and the particular expression of someone who had already decided what he was going to find before he arrived to find it. Grace was in the library when Mrs. Vanessa appeared at the door and informed her, with a face that revealed absolutely nothing, that there was a visitor in the front receiving room requesting an audience with the Duke and Duchess together. The word together carried a weight that neither woman acknowledged aloud. Grace set down her sketchbook, smoothed her gown, and walked to the receiving room with her spine straight and her heartbeat carefully regulated, the way she had learned to manage herself in the days since Declan Robertson's visit had rearranged the furniture of her suspicions without moving a single visible piece. Patrick was already there when she arrived, standing beside the mantelpiece in a posture that suggested he had been informed and was already containing his displeasure at the intrusion. He glanced at Grace when she entered a brief, measuring glance, and then returned his attention to Sir Aldous, who had arranged himself in the chair across the room, with the comfortable authority of a man who considered every room he entered to be temporarily his. Sir Aldous explained his purpose with judicial economy. There had been questions raised he did not specify by whom regarding the circumstances of the Jameson marriage, the speed of it, the timing relative to the late Lord Sutherland's financial collapse, the lack of any formal courtship on public record. He was not, he wished to clarify, making accusations. He was simply conducting a routine inquiry on behalf of the Crown's social registry, which had an interest in ensuring the legitimacy of all peerages and their attached unions. He looked at Grace with eyes like cold water and asked her how long she had known the Duke before the marriage. Grace opened her mouth to answer. Patrick spoke first. He did not raise his voice. He did not move from the mantelpiece. But something changed in the room, a shift in pressure, the way a change in weather makes itself known before the clouds arrive and Sir Aldous's pen stopped moving above his folio. Patrick said that he had known Grace Sutherland for considerably longer than the public record reflected. He said that the absence of formal courtship in the social register was a matter of private discretion, not irregular conduct, that he had made a deliberate choice to keep their understanding between themselves until the appropriate moment, because Grace was not a woman to be paraded before the ton as a prospect, but a woman to be protected from the scrutiny that his name attracted. He said that her father's financial difficulties had made the timing urgent, but the decision had not been made in urgency. It had been made long before debt entered the conversation, he said, and this was the moment Grace's breath caught, in a way she did not fully control, that he had sat across a room from Grace Sutherland and understood, with a clarity that did not require courtship or convention to validate it, that she was a woman of more intelligence and more integrity than most of the men in Parliament combined, and that any institution which required him to justify that recognition was welcome to find him unconvinced by its objections. Sir Aldous looked at him for a long moment. Then he looked at Grace. Grace held his gaze with everything she had. She did not look at Patrick, though every instinct she possessed was pulling her in that direction. She simply sat with the weight of what had just been said, settling over her like something that had always been present and had only now been made visible. Sir Aldous closed his folio. He said he was satisfied that the inquiry could be marked as resolved. He thanked them for their time, collected his assistants from the hallway like footnotes, and left. The door closed. The room was very quiet. Grace turned to look at Patrick, and found him already looking away, facing the mantelpiece again, his jaw set, his hands clasped behind his back. The words he had just spoken were still in the air between them, as solid and present as furniture, and he was behaving as though neither of them had heard them. She did not ask him to explain. She understood, with a precision that surprised her, that asking him to account for what he had just said would be the fastest way to make him bury it. She simply said, quietly, that she thought the inquiry had gone well. Patrick agreed that it had. He said the carriage for the masquerade would need to be confirmed for the following Saturday. He said Mrs. Vanessa would attend to the arrangements. He left the room. Grace sat alone in the chair closest to the window and watched the gray London morning press against the glass and thought about a man who could deliver a defense like a declaration and then walk away from it as though he had only commented on the weather. She thought about this for rather a long time. It was the tea that first made her pay attention, not her own. She took her morning tea in the small breakfast room, alone, poured from a pot brought by one of the younger household maids, a quiet girl named Bethel who moved with the careful attentiveness of someone who wanted very much to do everything correctly. There was nothing unusual about Grace's tea. It was the Duke's tea that concerned her. She had noticed it first by accident, passing the corridor outside the study one morning when the door stood open and Mrs. Vanessa was inside, arranging the afternoon tray with her back to the door. There was nothing overtly suspicious in the action. Mrs. Vanessa had arranged trays in this house for years before Grace arrived, and would presumably arrange them long after, in the way that certain fixtures of a household become indistinguishable from the architecture itself. But Grace was an artist, which meant she noticed things. Angles, shadows, small misalignments between what was visible and what was felt and what she felt, watching Mrs. Vanessa's hands move over the tea service with a particular, private deliberateness, was a cold and spreading unease she could not immediately name. She said nothing. She moved on, but she began to watch. Over the following days, she noticed that Patrick's energy in the evenings was different from his energy in the mornings. Not dramatically different, not the kind of change that would register to someone who wasn't paying close attention, but Grace was paying close attention, with the same focused observation she brought to a blank page when she was trying to understand what it wanted to become. In the mornings, he was sharp, precise, the calculated, formidable man whose reputation had been constructed from exactly that quality. By evening, particularly after the study tea had been taken, there was a flatness to him, a slight slowing. His eyes, always watchful, became less so. He answered questions with less economy and more effort, as though the words required more retrieval than usual. She began to find reasons to be near the study in the afternoons. On the fourth day, she arrived at the corridor just as Bethel was carrying the tray out, meaning Mrs. Vanessa had already been inside, and the tea had already been prepared. Grace asked Bethel, with the bright casualness of a woman making conversation, whether the household always used the same blend for the Duke's afternoon service. Bethel said yes, always the same blend. Though, she added, with the slight uncertainty of someone reporting something they hadn't been asked to notice, Mrs. Vanessa always prepared the Duke's cup herself and asked that the other maids leave the tray to her. Always. Grace thanked her and continued down the corridor with her hands folded calmly in front of her and her mind moving at a speed that had nothing to do with calm at all. She could not accuse Mrs. Vanessa without proof. She understood that with perfect clarity. An accusation without evidence, leveled against a woman who had served this household for decades, from a duchess who had been here less than a month, would accomplish nothing except to make Grace appear hysterical and Mrs. Vanessa appear victimized. It would also alert whoever was directing Mrs. Vanessa that Grace had noticed and that advantage was not one she was willing to surrender. She thought of Declan Robertson, his pleasant face, the careful way he had planted each word like a seed in prepared ground. She thought of the West Wing and the children sleeping in rooms she was forbidden to know about. She thought of a man who had stood before a magistrate and defended her with the quiet force of someone speaking a truth they had been carrying for a very long time. She went to her room and sat at the writing desk and worked out, methodically and without panic, exactly what she was going to do. The masquerade began at 9 o'clock on a Saturday evening, and by 10, the Jameson Ballroom was full of candlelight and silk, and the layered sound of an orchestra, competing with the noise of 200 people performing the social theater of Regency England at its most elaborate. Grace wore deep emerald, her hair pinned high, a feathered half-mask covering the upper portion of her face. Patrick stood beside her at the entrance to the ballroom in a black coat, and a mask that did nothing to diminish the quality of deliberate stillness he carried everywhere, the kind of stillness that made a room orient around him without his having to request it. They received their guests together. Grace had not told him what she suspected about the tea. She had made a decision, arrived at over 3 days of careful thought, that telling Patrick outright would either cause him to confront Mrs. Vanessa immediately and expose the plan prematurely, or, and this possibility troubled her more, he would not believe her. He was a man who trusted what he could prove. She had not yet proven anything. She had only the pattern, and her instincts, and the particular weight of a woman's observation that men of Patrick's world had a long history of dismissing. So she had done something else entirely. She had quietly ensured that on the evening of the masquerade, the Duke's afternoon tea went untouched. She had arranged, through Bethel and a small fiction about the Duke, preferring to take his refreshment in the library that day for the study tray to go undelivered. It was a fragile plan. It depended on Bethel's cooperation and Mrs. Vanessa's failure to notice, and Grace was aware that both of those things were uncertainties she could not fully control. But Patrick had been sharp all evening, alert, present, watching the room with the full force of his attention, which meant the plan, at least in its first part, had held. She did not know what part two would look like. She only knew it was coming. It arrived shortly after 11. The candles went out, not gradually, not one section at a time in the way of candles burning down. All at once, as though someone had given a command to the darkness, and the darkness had obeyed. The ballroom plunged into a black, so sudden and complete that the music stopped mid-phrase and the room erupted in confused voices and the sound of bodies moving without direction. Grace did not move. She stood exactly where she was and let her eyes adjust, and in the thin amber glow of the fireplace at the far end of the ballroom, she could make out shapes, guests clustering, staff moving along the walls, and three figures entering from the servants' corridor, who did not move the way staff moved, and were not dressed the way guests dressed. She reached for Patrick's arm in the dark. He was already gone. The voices around her shifted from confusion to something closer to alarm. Someone near the door was shouting for order. Someone else was crying. Grace pressed herself back against the wall and moved along it toward the corridor that connected the ballroom to the east wing, because if Declan's men had entered through the servants' passage, then the other exit, the one that opened onto the garden terrace, was either already compromised or still accessible, and she needed to know which. She found out when she pushed open the terrace door and nearly walked into the man standing on the other side of it. Not Patrick. Not one of the guests. Declan Robertson, without his pleasant expression, stood on the rain-soaked terrace with two men behind him and a face that had finally stopped performing likability. He wore no mask. He had not come to the masquerade as a guest. He looked at Grace with the specific displeasure of a man whose plan has encountered a variable it did not account for. He told her, with a directness he had not used during his visit to the sitting room, that she should go back inside. That what happened next was between him and his cousin and had nothing to do with her. Grace said nothing. She stood in the doorway with rain blowing sideways across the terrace and the sounds of the disrupted ballroom behind her, and she looked at Declan Robertson with the expression of a woman who had spent 3 weeks inside a fortress, learning the language of danger, and had stopped being afraid of the dialect. Her hand, hidden in the folds of her gown, closed around the small flintlock pistol she had taken from her trunk 3 days ago. Her father's, old but maintained. She had cleaned it herself, quietly, in her room, because she was her father's daughter in ways that had nothing to do with his failures. Declan took a step toward her. A sound from the garden below stopped him. Patrick came around the corner of the terrace balustrade at a pace that was not a gentleman's pace, his mask gone, his coat dark with rain, and his eyes those unreadable, deliberate eyes fixed entirely on Declan, with an expression Grace had not seen there before, not the cold efficiency of the receiving room or the careful control of the library, something older than that, and far less contained. Declan's men moved. Patrick was faster than either of them expected, and the scuffle that followed was brief and brutal, and entirely unlike anything Grace had witnessed in 23 years of drawing room living. One man went down against the stone balustrade. The second caught Patrick across the shoulder with something that gleamed in the firelight from the ballroom windows, and Patrick's movement changed slower, left side favoring. Declan reached into his coat. Grace raised the pistol and fired. The sound cracked across the garden, and the rain and the remnants of the orchestra music still bleeding from inside the manor. Declan's hand jerked back. The blade he had drawn skittered across the wet stone of the terrace and vanished into the dark. Everything stopped. Patrick turned to look at her. Rain was running down his face, his jaw, the sharp line of his collar. His left hand was pressed to his shoulder. He was staring at her with an expression she had never seen on him before, not in the receiving room, not in the library, not in the terrible quiet of the rooms they occupied like careful strangers. He looked, for the first time since Grace Sutherland had walked into his life with a gold pocket watch and a desperate request, entirely undone. Declan was on his knees on the wet stone, clutching his hand, his pleasant face finally stripped of everything it had been using to cover what was underneath. Two of Patrick's household guard arrived through the garden gate at a run, and behind them, one of the Crown's men Patrick had not, it turned out, been entirely unprepared for the evening's possibilities. Mrs. Vanessa was found inside the manor before the night was over, in the act of removing a package from the back of the kitchen pantry that contained, among other things, correspondence in Declan's handwriting that documented 3 years of careful, systematic planning. The manufactured debt. The barrister who had delivered the ultimatum to Grace on Declan's instruction. The sedative introduced gradually into Patrick's afternoon tea to dull his instincts in increments too small to notice until it was too late to matter. It was all there. Every thread of it, tied together in ink that could not be retracted. Grace stood in the rain on the terrace and watched them lead Mrs. Vanessa through the garden, and felt something she had not felt in a very long time. Not triumph. Something quieter than that. The particular stillness of a thing that has been carrying enormous weight finally being allowed to set it down. Patrick appeared beside her. His shoulder had been bound with cloth from inside the manor, makeshift and insufficient, and he was moving with the careful economy of a man managing pain without acknowledging it, which Grace recognized as a habit so deeply ingrained, it had probably stopped feeling like a choice years ago. She looked at the binding on his shoulder, then at his face. She told him he needed a physician. He said one had been sent for. They stood in the rain for a moment without speaking, which was, Grace thought, somehow more honest than most of the conversations they had managed inside the manor's perfectly preserved rooms. Then Patrick said her name. Not Duchess. Not a reference to her role or her position or the terms of any contract. Her name, with a weight to it that suggested he had been carrying it carefully for longer than the occasion required. He said he owed her an explanation. About the children in the West Wing. About her father's debts, the real ones, and the ones that had been built around him like a cage. About a gallery in Kensington 4 years ago, where he had stood at the back of the room and watched a young woman move through her own exhibition with the kind of quiet, fierce pride that did not require anyone else's validation, and had understood something about her in that moment that he had spent 4 years failing to act on. He had been paying the minor debts. The real ones. The ones her father had accumulated honestly through poor judgment rather than Declan's manipulation. He had done it anonymously, through a solicitor, because he had not known how to do anything directly where Grace Sutherland was concerned, and because the alternative watching her world narrow and contract under the weight of her father's failures while he did nothing had been something he found he could not tolerate. He had not anticipated Declan accelerating the timeline. He had not anticipated the manufactured ultimatum, the false debts, the barrister arriving at her door with a sunset deadline. By the time he understood what was happening, she was already standing in the ballroom. He said, standing in the rain with his shoulder bleeding through the binding and his hair plastered flat, and every wall he had spent years constructing, lying somewhere in pieces around the garden terrace, he said that he was aware the explanation was long overdue. Grace looked at him for a long time. Then she told him that for a man who had spent years operating in political circles that required precision and foresight, he had managed the situation with a spectacular lack of both. Patrick looked at her. Something moved in his face that had been absent from it for what appeared to be a considerable portion of his adult life. He laughed. Briefly. Quietly. Like a man remembering how. Declan Robertson was taken before the Crown's judiciary within the fortnight. The evidence was thorough, and the case was not complicated, and men who manufactured the financial ruin of peers' families and directed armed infiltrations of titled estates did not find the bench sympathetic regardless of their own connections. He was stripped of his social standing and removed from London. He did not look pleasant on the morning he left. Mrs. Vanessa was dismissed and taken into custody for questioning, and the long-standing grudge she had carried against Patrick's father. A grudge born from a decision made before Patrick was old enough to have prevented it, was laid out in testimony that was both sad and damning, and contained the particular tragedy of a person who had chosen bitterness over everything else for so long that they had forgotten what the alternative felt like. The children in the West Wing, 7 of them, aged between 4 and 11, sons and daughters of men who had been destroyed by Patrick's father's failed political campaigns and left with nothing, were not a secret. Grace kept. She did not announce them to the ton, or make their presence a subject of drawing room conversation. But she walked into the West Wing the morning after the masquerade, in the clear gray light of a London dawn, and she did not pretend she had not been there before. She brought sketchbooks. She brought charcoal and soft pencils and a patience for sitting on floors that the manor's furniture budget had not anticipated. The children, who had learned to be quiet and careful and invisible in the way that children do when the world has taught them that visibility is dangerous, watched her with the guarded curiosity of small people, deciding whether something was safe. By the second week, they had decided. Patrick found her there one afternoon, cross-legged on the West Wing floor with a small girl named Isobel asleep against her shoulder, and 3 of the older children arranged around her sketchbook, arguing in whispers about the best way to draw a horse. He stood in the doorway and watched, and his expression had the quality of a man looking at something he had not known he was waiting for until it was directly in front of him. Grace looked up and met his eyes. Neither of them said anything. There was, by that point, a growing understanding between them that silence was not always the absence of communication. The new contract was drawn up on a Tuesday morning, 3 weeks after the masquerade. It was not a legal document. It had no barrister's seal, no formal witness, no clause about West Wings or private studies or the careful management of affection. It was a single page, handwritten, in Grace's clear and slightly artistic script, because she was the better writer and both of them knew it. It said, in language that was not formal and was not cold, and bore no resemblance whatsoever to the document signed in candlelight, with a sunset deadline pressing against the windows, that they were choosing this, not from desperation, not from debt, not from a clock running out of hours, but from the particular, hard-won, unlikely understanding of two people who had spent weeks inside the same fortress, slowly dismantling each other's defenses, one quiet evening at a time. Grace set it on the writing desk. Patrick read it. He picked up the pen. He paused, with the pen above the page, and looked at her with the expression he had worn in the rain on the terrace, the expression of a man without walls, which was not something Duke Patrick Jameson had been seen without in recent memory. He said it was not precisely a contract. Grace said no. It was something more binding than that. He signed his name. She signed hers, beneath his. The morning light came through the library windows and fell across the page, and outside in the garden the day was beginning in the ordinary, unhurried way that days begin when the crisis is over and the ordinary business of living can resume. Somewhere in the west wing, Isabel was arguing with the oldest boy about breakfast. Bethel's footsteps crossed the corridor above. The manor, which had been a museum when Grace arrived, made the sounds of a house that was considering, slowly and with some effort, becoming a home. Grace looked at her signature beside his on the page and thought of the pocket watch, still in her jewelry box upstairs. Still ticking, no longer counting down, just keeping time. The way time is meant to be kept not as a threat, but as a record of everything still to come. And that is where Grace Sutherland's story rests tonight. Not at an ending, but at a beginning. The kind that only becomes possible after everything false has been burned away. She came to that ballroom with nothing but a name, and 4 hours and a will that refused to break. She signed a contract with a man the world called ruthless. She walked into a fortress and found, behind every locked door and every careful silence, a person choosing to protect instead of destroy in the only language he had ever been taught. And she stayed. Not because she had to, because she chose to. If this story moved something in you, if you have ever held on when everything was telling you to let go, if you have ever looked past what someone showed the world and seen what they were hiding underneath, then you know exactly what Grace Sutherland felt in that library on a Tuesday morning, with a pen in her hand and a future that finally belonged to her. This is Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles. If you have watched this far and felt every moment of it, then you are exactly who this channel was made for. Hit that subscribe button so you never have to miss what comes next. Drop a comment below and tell me where in the world you are watching from tonight, because these stories travel further than you know, and every single one of you matters here, like this story. Share it with someone who needs to believe that the underdogs win sometimes. Hit the notification bell so you are here when the next secret is ready to be told. You are part of this family now, and we are only just getting started.